think that we already recorded after the welcoming banquet was over, the senator and Anna Chennault came to the residence for the purpose of talking with me. And I think that was the day that she'd had her private meeting with Deng Xiaoping, which the Chinese, of course, publicized in their press quite a bit. And she went out of her way to tell me that, of course, I knew she had come here directly from Taiwan. And I said, yes, I knew that. And she said that the authorities there were enthusiastic about her visit. The way in which she went out of her way to do it, with, I don't know quite what she was trying to convey, whether it be to indicate that her visit had greater importance than in fact it had, or I mean, I don't know why she'd want to tell the American ambassador that the authorities in Taiwan were sympathetic with her coming here to see coming to Peking to see Deng Xiaoping. Let's go off.
Just on the Chennault visit, before we move on, what do you think her purpose was on that visit? Was she trying to? Was she anticipating arms sales to China? Was she really trying to promote some kind of contact between Taiwan and China, or was she just trying to return to the motherland?
In some of her comments, talking about the general and when last they had been in Peking, which of course would many, many years before. It's very possible that it was a sentimental journey. I can't see why, if it were of significance as far as Taiwan itself was concerned, why they would want it to be so highly publicized. But what signals she gave were really contradictory. The ones I was talking about in her conversation with me. And actually, they made that special visit out to the residence. Nothing much was said, really, in that talk except for her to make those points. But we were puzzled by it and never did get any possibly straight answer.
It is difficult to ever ascertain from that lady, I suppose, what the set of motives were. I remember my reaction learning that she was going is that the Chinese were really beginning to come in contact with the kind of people that helped bring on the Chinese Revolution to start with. I didn't know whether to be pleased or sorry that she was there.
Well, the Chinese were very pleased with the visit. They were obviously extremely happy about her coming there. I suppose it suited their purpose to make it appear that Taiwan was now coming to them instead of always the other way around.
Good point. Good point.
Soon after this,
just one other thing about that before we leave. Not only was Chennault was with Stevens, right? With Senator Stevens.
Ted Stevens.
And right. From a political point of view,
Ted Stevens' new wife.
That's right.
He'd just been recently remarried.
from a political point of view, the presence of Stevens there was in some ways as significant as Anna Chenault. Stevens, as I recall, was one of the first people to perform the intermediary role between the new Republican president and the Chinese. He spoke, he was the deputy leader, wasn't he?
And he was also substituting for Howard Baker.
For Baker. So he was coming
twice
to that.
Scheduled to
That's right.
come and had to postpone for whatever reason.
So he brought a message from Howard Baker, and the issue of arms sales to China came up during Stevens' visit, and Stevens endorsed arms sales to China
right.
at a press conference. Stevens is in the Senate a disciple or protege, maybe, I don't know quite what the right word is, of Senator Jackson. They are very close on China policy. Jackson has cultivated Stevens' views for a long time.
He was very positive in his reactions to China. Then at the end of the year, 1980, I had been informed by the station chief that the CIA director, Admiral Stansfield Turner, was coming on an extremely secret mission. No one was to know about it. And he came, spent six or seven days, and no one in the embassy knew about it except Jack Downing and myself. I went to the welcoming dinner given for him by General Wu, head of Chinese military intelligence, and also to the return banquet that the Admiral gave for the Chinese on the 5th of January, and he left the next day. Both of those dinners, of course, were in the Great Hall. I think I knew where he was staying, but I think he stayed at some military installation. And he
traveled incognito, didn't he?
Yes.
He had come in disguise.
I suppose you could call it in disguise. On a couple of occasions, he was in the Peking Hotel, I think, as I remember it. Yeah.
He had a mustache or something like that, or a beard?
He'd grown a mustache for the purpose, a very luxuriant one. And anyone who knew him well certainly would not have been thrown off by the so-called disguise. But no one was at all aware of the visit beyond those who were supposed to be.
Who was present at the dinner for him, in addition to General Wu?
They were very small. One table, as I remember it, and all military people.
Han Xu there, too?
I think Han was there, yes. And who was the man in the foreign ministry with whom Jack dealt all the time on?
John.
Chestnut.
John Wei.
Yes.
John Wei.
In fact, maybe
sure.
He was there and Han was not there.
Uh-huh.
I was not in any of the meetings which he had. I remember Jack telling me that in one of the meetings, they got on the question of the Sino-Soviet confrontational problems, and he took them step by step through what could be nuclear strikes, limited nuclear strikes to achieve tactical objectives, Jack had the feeling that the Chinese were really, really shocked that they was thinking, his interpretation was that they were thinking in terms of purely conventional war, the tank invasion and a takeover comparable to the Japanese, whereby they'd still be able to surround the invading army by slipping behind them and so on. And it was Jack's impression that they had not at all taken into their considerations this type of the use of nuclear weaponry.
But their deployment of their own nuclear weapons would suggest that they recognized the tactical use of weapons. You know what I'm referring to? That
yes.
They would use it on their the deployment of their own missiles suggests a willingness to use nuclear weapons on their own soil in lesser populated areas to eliminate enemy invading forces.
Well, this was purely impressionistic. This was not anything as I remember it, it was not anything that was said. It was just his impressions of what their reactions were.
So Turner had some substantial conversations while there, too.
Oh, yes.
Not just a
yeah.
tourist visit. He went west, too, probably?
I think so, yes. He was gone out of the five, six days, he was gone two or three. But he was very, very pleased with his visit at the end. Van Len Unger, who of course had been out.
Just before we go, a little more on Wu Shouchuan. What kind of person was he at these dinners, and did you learn anything about him?
Oh, he was very relaxed and charming and quite, quite open in his conversation. I didn't learn any more about him in those two particular instances than had been my feeling about him before. I'd always found him quite open. He was the one who was meeting with the House Armed Services Committee in April, right after the Vietnam invasion. We spoke very frankly of the fact the first 10 days that they got pretty badly roughed up because of their not giving proper account or taking properly into account the terrain. After they adjusted their tactics, and things went much better, but made no bones about the fact they got pretty badly handled the first 10 days. This was the first Chinese that I'd ever heard say anything like that. As I say, it was very, very soon after the event, about 3 months.
Wu has been around quite a while, and was on the Long March. He's just written an 80,000 character description of the Zuni Conference, which was a meeting on the Long March at which major leadership changes were made. He's written several other articles of his memoirs about his memoirs recently. And it's clear he has been involved in many, many major decisions. And I assumed, and his meeting Turner's further underscores, he's been, in effect, their chief intelligence officer for years, foreign intelligence officer.
Then, right after the turn of the year in 1981, Ambassador Len Unger, our last ambassador in Taiwan, visited China. And the Chinese treated him very well. reception at the residence for him and invited all the appropriate Chinese who all accepted the invitations and came. And then CAAC, on January the 7th, 1981, made its first inaugural flight to Shanghai and on to San Francisco and on to New York. And that was a very joyous occasion out at the airport saying goodbye to that 747. Then Codel Fuque came on January the 10th with a delegation of 38 science and chairman of the Science and Technology Committee in the House.
He represents a very distinguished district from North Florida.
Oh, your birthplace. And we had a reception at the residence for that delegation. As I say, there were 38 in the delegation, and together with the additional Americans and all the Chinese who came, the total was about 125. And they were received, of course, by Vice Premier Fong Yi, since their interests were science and technology. About 2 weeks before that, there was a social, some Chinese from the Academy of Social Sciences, and one of them had asked me if I knew Vasily Leontief, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, and I said yes. He and I were good friends, and he said, "Would I receive a Chinese professor who had been a student of Leontief's at Harvard?" And I said, "Of course." And he said, "Well, I will have her call you for an appointment." So Quan Xu was her name. And it turned out, not surprising for a student of Leontief's, she was an input-output economist. And she had been a graduate student at Harvard under Leontief. And she told me that Leontief had wanted her to stay in America. She had a daughter, I believe. And but she made the decision to return to China, which she did in 56 or 57. And it may have been somewhat later than that, because she had not been many years in China after her return before the Cultural Revolution came. Nothing particularly badly happened to her, except she said, "You don't know how it is to spend 12 years on the shelf." She spoke excellent English. I think those were exact words. "You don't know how it is to spend 12 years on the shelf." And I asked her, well, she said Leontief had urged her to come and see me. And so I said, asked her, "How did she hear from Leontief?" Well, she had gone a year ago to a conference, an international conference in Vienna on input-output economics. And she was a member of the Chinese delegation. And she had seen him there, and it was at that time that he urged that she come and talk to me. But she said, "It took me a long time to make up my mind to do it. But hearing that you are leaving, I decided to come and see you." And she said, "You know, I didn't want to be a delegate to that conference because I said I haven't seen any of the recent work, and it's many, many years since I was exposed. I will be of no use." And I was told by the authorities, "You are the only one we have who has any familiarity with input-output theory." And so she was a delegate for that reason. decision. She was perfectly calm, and a woman, I would guess, that in her late 50s by this time. But again, like so many who talked about it, no apparent bitterness, which is hard to understand. Then we had quite a
flat. Was she asking you for assistance of some sort?
No.
Implicitly, you think?
No.
Where was she located at the time?
She was by this time in one of the research institutions.
The Chinese Academy of Social Sciences.
I think so, yes. Probably because it was an official of the association that had asked would I receive her. Then we had a big flap with the Chinese over the question of the Taiwan presence at the inaugural ceremonies, which were to take place on the 20th of January. And
I was in China at that time.
You had a meeting with Zhang Wenjian at his request on it on Saturday morning the 17th. And yes, when I had the second meeting with him on the afternoon of Monday, January the 19th, and of course by this time it's getting mighty close to the inaugural itself, you were at the residence for breakfast that morning. And there had been some informal discussions in addition. And the Chinese, I had to describe to the Chinese in detail how these things were. Of course, there had been invitations, as you know, offered to all and sundry in Taiwan by almost everybody. And then when I was instructed to tell the Chinese that the only official invitations would be to the representatives of the People's Republic of China, to Ambassador Chai Zemin, and I had described earlier how I thought it would be, but then Reagan, of course, switched to the other side of the Capitol. So that there's that immense space that almost anybody could come to. My Lord, it could hold a million people, I guess, or more.
Sure, all the way to the monument.
Whereas on the other side, it was relatively restricted. And at one point, they wanted to guarantee that nobody from Taiwan would be anywhere in the vicinity. And I had to say that. That's impossible because there would be no such restrictions. And of course, the inaugural committee, under instruction, did hold the official invitations only to Chai Zemin, and that is what happened. Because on the 19th, I was able to tell them that the governor, I think it was, of Taiwan province, of the main province of Taiwan, whatever that is, would not be able to accept his invitation because he was ill. Would still be ill 24 hours from now.
Now, who were you dealing with in Washington through this?
Through the State Department.
But who was Dick Holbrooke sending the cables on how the Reagan administration was going to handle the inauguration?
I think it was through Chas Freeman. Yeah, Chas Freeman.
And then Chai Zemin presumably was also in there protesting to Chas directly.
I would assume so, yes. Or Chaz at least was in direct communication. communication with the embassy.
This is a good point to raise an issue that I don't think through all these many hours we've touched upon. What was your impression of how well the foreign ministry was briefed by Chai Zemin of events that happened in Washington? In other words, there are two channels, right? State Department could communicate to you and you could go tell Han Chu. Or we could tell Chai Zemin in Washington and he could communicate to Han Chu. What was the difference between those two channels?
I never could get clear in my mind just how good their communications were. I'm positive that Chai Zemin would have communicated everything that he possibly could, and was very conscientious in the carrying out of his duties. And I think particularly with regard to this incident we were talking about, that he was sending all the information he possibly could get.
My impression is that on short-term matters of high priority, Chai could be relied upon. But when it came to anything less than that, the preferable channel was to send a cable to you and have you and your assistants go directly to the ministry involved or to the foreign ministry, as the case would be.
Well, that's possibly true, and it was more than one occasion when Han Chu would indicate, make some inquiry of me, and sort of say in passing, you know, our communications, meaning in a mechanical sense, with our embassy are not as fast as yours. In other words, giving that as the excuse for whatever the inquiry might have been.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's possibly true.
But Chai also, I got the sense in one of my visits, Chai did not keep the embassy informed very much about his travels, his activities. On the other hand, when you travel through China, you always sent a report cable back about your trip, about your impressions, whether there were any perceived differences in policy at the locality, those that were being urged in Peking. I get the impression, and it's strictly that, I get the impression that Chai is not in the custom of providing those kind of report cables. Do you ever have any evidence that he was doing that?
I don't know. I really don't know. You know, and he has traveled a great deal. He's traveled far more than Huang Zhen. I guess traveled almost not at all. Or even Han Chu, except at the very end.
Right.
But he had the reputation when he was in Bangkok of really being active, particularly among the Chinese citizens, Chinese, the Thai citizens of Chinese descent. So not to report on it would be somewhat inconsistent with that behavior, it would seem to me, but I really don't know.
But can you recall Han Chu telling you Chai has been to such and such a place, or we got an interesting report from Chai that he was out in Los Angeles, or if something in Los Angeles arose, there was an indication that Chai was there? I just can't remember a conversation which reflects an intimate, not even an intimate, but I'd say a sense that the ambassador is performing a role for them. He just doesn't crop up in conversations on the Peking end.
No, I can't remember any such thing. No.
Yep, we know he does. I have one evidence that I just was thinking of, but comes much later in time. I saw Ji Chao Ju recently and the subject of arms sales to Taiwan came up. This was at a reception in Washington about 4 weeks ago, and he referred in that meeting to the conversation that you had and that I had with Ambassador Chai here in my Ann Arbor house in November of 1981. So maybe they just, maybe their security is that they just don't talk about their recording cables they receive.
Be the U.S. Social Sciences and Human Planning Delegation.
Oh, Humanities Delegation.
Humanities.
That's the one that I was on.
Ah, because remember the meeting you had with Boy Bull lasted for 2 hours.
That's right.
Very, very long and interesting meeting.
That's right. We had a meeting on the future of research in China for American Social Science Humanities. We were trying to secure continued field research opportunities. Bo was under guidance from his aides to shut the door on it, and we tried to nibble away. You will remember that was a meeting where, I think the only time I recall, where I saw the Chinese caucus, the staff people caucus, while the vice premier was talking, Ji Chaozhu. A couple others went down and talked with Wang Guangmei because Bo had begun to say field research was essential in order to understand a society. Do you remember that at all? You've been to so many of these, you don't
probably
not remember them. But and then Wang Guangmei interrupted the vice premier and said, "May I say a few words?" And then she came in and went back to the original talking points.
Then on the 27th, you were present at the small luncheon we had with Wan Xiang. He had one of the Chinese with him. There were two of them, I remember. Although
Zhao Fusan.
Yes. And it was you and Stabe Roy and myself. I remember being somewhat surprised at how tough Juan was on the Taiwan question, much more than he had ever been before. And we talked about it afterwards, whether this was because of the change of administrations or just what?
And the kind of the sense that he had acquired during his trip to the United States that the next administration was likely to be more embracing of Taiwan. You remember that he attended a conference at Williamsburg in very early
right.
January, and the meeting with him, that luncheon to which you graciously invited me, was to obtain a sense from him of his perceptions of Sino-American relations after about a month in the U.S. He had a number of points to make, all of which, in retrospect, turn out to have been quite important. He eventually, his foreign affairs article was based on those impressions, but he had, as I recall, one of his points was that we must base our relationship on more than our common animosity toward the Soviet Union. The relationship has to be based on long-term interests. Secondly, that we need not fear that China...
All of which was positive.
I mean, positive.
We were all in agreement on that.
Absolutely. And then secondly, that we should not, that he feared still a lingering view of seeing China in ideological terms as a communist country. Tried to downplay that, and then the Taiwan issue, I don't remember the fourth, but he had these four rather interesting themes, I thought. Oh, yes, and that we tended to look down on the Chinese and did not take them seriously as a power, that they weren't,
that's right.
And
Yes. That we had the, what the Chinese call the off-the-record meeting out at guest house number 3. Again, there was you and Steve Roy and myself, and Zhang Wenjin, and Pu Shoujung, Ji Zhaoju, and Feifei.
Joined for dinner by Sharon and Steve's wife.
Right, Sandy Roy.
Sandy.
And Mrs. Zhang.
And Han Xu's wife, I think. Maybe wrong about that.
I don't think she was in Peking at the time.
Oh, she was in the Washington, in the,
right.
the United
yeah.
States, in New York. That's right.
But, see, we talked a great, great length about the economy, right? And they were going out of their way to say how long this reconstruction, reorganization period would take, but that the right things were finally being done.
Right, and we talked about the damage that they may be doing to themselves in terms of their credibility in dealing with Western corporations through the deferral of contracts.
Right.
I talked about what a transition means, how records are passed from one administration to another. And then we thought through how, what were some of the measures to immediately, that might be used to reach the new administration. It was, at least from my part, an evening of saying farewell and trying to assist in providing continuity and policy.
It was a very, very interesting and very pleasant afternoon and evening.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the country music at dinner, I recall. What happened, Leonard, on January 20th itself, as far as you were concerned? Dick Holbrooke left. Did you receive a cable to stay at your post until further notice?
No. Let me get into that.
What happens as an administration leaves office, and what are the formalities as the people with whom you've communicated for 3 years leave?
Well, the persons with whom one's been associated, well, we had an exchange of cables, you know, which I can attach those to.
Let's do that.
To this report.
Good.
And of course, it's traditional for all persons who hold office by virtue of a presidential appointment, including, of course, career people, but who have been appointed by the president. I guess it's to posts that require confirmation, or is it more than that?
I don't know.
Anyway, it's traditional that after the election, that you submit your resignation. And this also holds even if the incumbent president has been reelected. That's a good tradition because it assumes that the president entering a new term, whether it be a second term or his first term, well, obviously if it's his first term, he has that right anyway. Even the first term, he has to have all those resignations, so he's absolutely free to put people in of his own choosing without having to go through the business of removing somebody. So that consistent with that tradition, I had, of course, sent in to the president-elect my my resignation. It also requires, it's also called for that you send a copy of that when known to the Secretary of State designate in my case, saying in that whatever you wish, together with a copy of the letter to the President. I had done this in to the President several weeks before, and then at the point that Alexander Haig was designated as Secretary, I think there was a slowness in that, wasn't there?
It was in January.
Yeah, so I hadn't acted. But
definitely
then
it was some time later than Vance had been designated, which I think was before Christmas. But I think
yes,
in this
it
case,
was.
It was after January 1st. The skirmishing had already begun between liberal and conservative Republicans as to who was acceptable
right.
and who was not.
So that second step I hadn't taken because of not knowing to whom to send it. But then it was, I think, in the week between Christmas and New Year, a telephone call came, and to State Roy, indicating that there had been a meeting by Dick Allen, who I think was already designated as the head of the National Security, as the National Security Advisor. With Dick Holbrooke, in which supposedly Allen had said that if Woodcock knew what was good for him, he would not be in Peking anymore by the 20th of January. It would be well if I had not only offered the resignation, but in fact departed my post officially before that date, and that I was to know this, but could not indicate in any way how I knew it. So when State passes on to me, I just said, "Well, I'm not going to get out." Get out early. If they want something done quickly, they'll have to take the steps to bring it about. But I was full of curiosity, and so after a few days, I decided to call Dick Holbrooke. Now, I couldn't tell him that I have been given this information. What about it? I said, "I'm sure you know, Dick, there's all sorts of Americans coming through here," which was true. There was a lot of traffic after the election and before the inauguration. And I said, "There's been more than one indicated that there's some pressure to get me out of here. It's an early date." I thought if in fact there had been such a conversation as it had been reported to me, he would have then said it. But he didn't say that. He said, "Well,